Good afternoon, everyone, and a very warm welcome to the second conversation in the series of conversations hosted by the Centre for Law, Gender and Sexuality, based at the Universities of Westminster, Keele and Kent. I'm Emma McLean, member of the Centre and lecturer in law here at the Law School at the University of Westminster. The aim of the conversation series is to exchange ideas between policymakers, academics, non-governmental organisations and activists. The hope is that it will increase understanding of the various fields of work and study. It provides an opportunity for everyone to participate, explore and exchange ideas, information and experiences. Today's conversation topic is trafficking, with a specific focus on the trafficking of women for sexual exploitation. And I'm very pleased to welcome our participants, Helen Atkins and Abigail Stepnitz from the Poppy Project based here in London, along with Zach Karen-Paz from the University of Keele and Dory Chetty, also from the University of Westminster. The conversation will be around 50 minutes of discussion between the participants, followed by 10 minutes of questions from our small invited audience of colleagues and graduate students. And the session is facilitated by myself, so without much further ado, we will get started. So, by way of general introduction, can each of you say something about yourselves, your organisation and the work that you do? Could you also say something about what attracted you to this area in the first place? And we'll begin with Dory. Thank you.
Okay. Hello, I'm Dory Chetty, lecturer at University of Westminster, and I'm interested in this area of research on several levels. As a feminist and a lecturer in the field of gender and development, in particular, and I'm interested in migration in the age of globalisation and the related issues of human rights. I believe that poverty, unemployment and war are the major underlying factors in explaining migration in our contemporary global world. And in addition, globalisation processes such as the liberalisation of trade and free market promotion have facilitated the movement of capital and labour. So on the one hand, borders have opened up for trade, capital and investors and individuals from wealthier countries, whilst on the other hand, people from poorer countries have do not have the same mobility. And on top of this, we live in a climate of restrictive immigration for some. So to me, it seems inevitable that trafficking will flourish under those conditions, and people who need to escape dire situations, whether it's starvation or political imprisonment and so on, will turn to traffickers for help in migrating. So in my research on gender development, it seems clear to me that although the patterns of movement are varied, migration, the economic and social dislocation which arise from distorted development process affects women predominantly, so it's not gender neutral. So I look at the issue of human trafficking, therefore, in the wider framework of migration.
Thank you very much, and over to Helen.
I'm Helen Atkins. I'm the Exiting Prostitution Development Officer from the Poppy Project. Poppy provides direct services for women who've been trafficked into the UK for the purposes of prostitution. We have referrals from almost 70 different countries across 5 different continents, and we've had over 1,000 women referred to the project since our inception in 2003. My interest in this area was born out of a fascination of the sex industry and a growing awareness of what people may term modern-day slavery, or better known as human trafficking. And the two combined inform the direction of my work, which is addressing issues around prostitution in relation to policy, research and development, but also looking at the relationship and the links between prostitution and sex trafficking.
Thank you. Zach.
Hi, my name is Zach Karen-Paz from Keele Law School. My interest in trafficking builds on two things. One, my previous work inserting equality into private law in general and tort law in particular. And the second, when I've been in my previous institution, Coleman Law School in Israel, I've been approached by an Israeli activist for an organization that fights human trafficking. and she asked me to have a look on a thought paper that she wrote, and since then we started collaborating. So the way I think of it is that we should develop effective and fair private law remedies to victims of sex trafficking or against all those involved directly or indirectly from violating the victim's rights. And these would include, in addition to the traffickers, clients, sex advertisers, and the state. And the remedies should be both loss-based and also gain-based, to strip the gains that other people, including the state, are making from trafficking.
Abigail. Thanks. So my name is Abigail Stepnitz, and I am Anti-Trafficking Research and Policy Officer at the Poppy Project. And my work focuses predominantly on women trafficked for labor exploitation, predominantly at the moment on women trafficked for domestic servitude in London. And I also look at sort of the larger issues around women trafficked into the UK for any form of exploitation. I came to this work academically through a human rights background, and after working in development in Latin America and India and seeing sort of the source side of trafficking there.
Thank you very much for your introductions and for setting the tone, I think, for the conversation. We're going to cluster the questions around three main themes. What is human trafficking? What are the responses to human trafficking? And how do we measure or map human trafficking? And so first we'll get started with the seemingly straightforward question of what is human trafficking? And in particular, it is the multifaceted nature of human trafficking, and in particular the different experiences of women. For instance, recent research suggests that trafficked women are not victims in need of rescuing. And in light of all this, can a consensus ever emerge as to what human trafficking is? So I'll hand over to Dory.
Okay, well, what is human trafficking? As Harriet Harman said, nothing less than modern day slavery. And this powerful piece of rhetoric has been seized upon by the popular media, and to a certain extent I think that has dictated the discourse. In dominant discourse, therefore, trafficking is seen as hugely profitable business in which organized criminals transport millions of human victims around the globe into conditions of slavery. Now, that analogy of the transatlantic slavery evokes powerful images, but I think it's misleading, and it also serves to obscure human rights violations which are commonly associated with the term trafficking. There are some crucial differences between the two. A major one is that victims of trafficking in modern day, in the contemporary global world, almost invariably want to move to another region or country, and they have compelling reasons for wanting to do so, which is very different to African slavery. So to me, this obscures the issues of the issues around violation rights.
Well, yes, no, I agree that the term modern-day slavery evokes perhaps images which don't apply in this day and age, and there are profound differences between the African slave trade and what we see today as human trafficking in the 21st century, however we may define it. Certainly it's important to make a clear distinction between smuggling on the one hand, people who seek out assistance in order to migrate and engage the services of someone in order to do that, compared to trafficking, whereby they may think they're approaching a smuggler who will help them to migrate, who actually turns out to be someone who is going to coerce and exploit them into a situation they do not want to be in. So in that sense, I think it is impossible for any victim of trafficking to choose to be trafficked. Certainly, a person may choose to be smuggled and may seek to migrate, but when the levels of exploitation, the living conditions, working conditions go beyond a certain point, then their situation may become turned from being one of being a smuggled person to being a victim of trafficking. And where that line is drawn is perhaps where this conversation will center.
I agree with Helen that we should distinguish between smuggling and trafficking. And a woman can choose to be smuggled, and she can also choose to be smuggled for purposes of work and prostitution. And despite the fact that it's almost always problematic to choose prostitution when it comes from financial deprivation, I'm even more concerned about more direct ways of coercion. So I think that the relevant definition for me to be would be, first of all, forced prostitution, which include also domestic forced prostitutes, and not only those who are trafficked over borders. And second, those who are forced to stay in prostitution by illegal threats, and they lose the control over the conditions of the work. That's it.
Now, Abigail, do you see something similar in forced labor?
I think just as it's important not to frame the human trafficking debate around immigration in terms of the way that we approach it from a sort of a crime or law perspective, it's also important not to let migration and migration issues be the way that we center the human rights discussion around human trafficking. And in terms of trafficking for labor exploitation, I do think that there are reasonable links to be drawn with slavery, even with the transatlantic slave trade, in terms of the end result of the exploitation, the type of exploitation. The movement is very different, but I don't necessarily take issue with comparing the type of work and the situations in which many women find themselves at the end result with the situations that we were all taught about in history class. While the movement does need to be characterized very differently, I think that exploitation, there is not a better comparison in terms of the situations in which many of these women find themselves.
I would like to add that there is a spectrum of the kind of coercion measures that are being used against women to force them to stay in prostitution. But some of them, which are not unprevalent, definitely could be equated with slavery. And I'm more familiar with the Israeli experience, and there are criminal convictions of traffickers in which, when you look at the facts, you see that these women were really treated like slaves, both in terms of that they were sold from one to another, and in the sense that they didn't have any kind of control over over their body and the services that they were forced to give to clients.
Mm. Yeah, but I think the biggest distinction between the transatlantic slave trade and human trafficking in this day and age is the fact that the slave trade was sanctioned by governments, and in that respect it's interesting to look at what's happening now and the level of state endorsement is given to trafficking in different parts of the world, and certainly we can look to various countries where with high levels of corruption, which may or may not have anti-trafficking legislation in place, but for all intents and purposes are operating relatively similarly to what was going on centuries ago. I would just like to pick up on the terminology around prostitution and forced prostitution against voluntary prostitution. I think when we talk about trafficking, there are some pieces of research which claim there is no such thing as a victim of sex trafficking, that everyone is a migrant sex worker. And I very much take issue with that. If someone seeks to migrate to improve their life, to follow their dream, and the only way in which they can do that is by selling sex, I think that raises profound questions over to the level of choice they actually have in that process, whether or not they are aware they will be working in the sex industry. The service users we work with, around a quarter of them imagine that they will be working within the sex industry, but never to the level at which they find themselves in. And I think there's it's very problematic to be talking about extreme coercion in this situation and what that means, and whether it's literally being chained to a bed, because usually it's not. Usually it's control mechanisms which take a much more psychological path.
I totally agree with that. What would get into my definition is not that not only threats of physical force or locking up with a key. We know that this is not the only means. I think the big issue is whether to include is a kind of relevant force, economic forces. And I think that here what I hear from Dory is that this should be excluded. And I guess I'm personally a bit ambivalent about that, because I tend to think that almost all prostitutes, I'm saying almost, but are forced due to either prior sexual abuse and mainly economical factors. So there's much to be said, to fight prostitution in general. But I think that there's a second layer when there's a human agency that prevents this woman who doesn't want to work in prostitution from going out. So I think that really we can't deny that these women should be included in the definition of forced, and then we can try and think whether we want a drug dependency. Does it should it be included when a minor starts as a prostitute, and then after that exit is so difficult? So could we say that this is a form of forced prostitution? But this is the next stage, I think.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that, and I think there is a tendency in popular discourse. And certainly within the multimedia representations around prostitution, is that it is a very fun, glamorous, increasingly accessible way to make a lot of money and perhaps travel the world. And that representation seems to take prevalence over what I would see as the realities. And almost in the mind, I think, of the public, there's this huge divide between being a sex slave, using those particular words, and then being a high-class escort. And I think it's very important when talking around sex trafficking to embrace the fact that there is this spectrum, and I would say most of it involves levels of coercion to some degree or other.
Mm. There appears to be a disjuncture then between what is actually happening on the ground. The voices of the women aren't actually being heard, either in policy or through the academic discourse. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there is a discourse. This is why I want to move away from either of the two sort of paradigms of either an excess focus on voluntarism or an excess focus on the sort of hyper-structural issues, because that, I think, stops us from seeing the agency at the local level. I think it sort of stops women from having a voice. And I think there is a dominant discourse from my work in development where those who are victims are more likely to get protection and assistance. So it's the notion of the deserving poor, I think, is still with us in that respect. And that's why I think I want to move away from the sort of victims discourse and move it onto agency. It's not to say that these women are not being exploited. And also in terms of exploitation, I think instead of just looking at prostitution and sex work as exploitation, we should also look at the violations in working conditions, poor working conditions, even under legal status, so that it doesn't become a moral issue as well in terms of prostitution, which I think sometimes it can happen. Some NGOs and some other researchers can, certainly radical feminists in the past, if I dare say so, may look at it in this way.
Well, yes, just to respond to that, I think the notion of deserving poor, and particularly the point about people who are perceived as being victims as getting lots of protection, I say is completely the other way around, and I think very few of the people who actually need protection currently receive it. I mentioned we'd had over 1,000 referrals. We only have 35 bed spaces, and we're the only project with statutory funding to provide direct services to women trafficked into this area. And so I think that there is a very vocal discourse, pro-sex work discourse, calling for a lot of very important things, human rights-based issues. And I think it's not a moral issue. It is a human rights issue. And if you're looking at victimhood, it's recognising that certainly the women we work with are extremely resourceful and capable, courageous, intelligent. You know, there's a huge range of women that we work with, but the fact remains that they have suffered gross human rights violations, and that doesn't give them the label of the deserving poor. Mm. It gives them the right to protection and assistance and empowerment and independence and ultimately freedom, which again is a word with all sorts of connotations attached to it.
Just on a policy note, in terms of who deserves protection and not, and sort of the way that the UK is going, we have seen some positive developments in that light of late. The way that the government is approaching the ratification of the Council of Europe Convention, at the moment, every woman who is identified as a victim of trafficking, and that is to say sort of rubber stamped by the Border and Immigration Authority, who are the competent authority when it comes to identifying victims of trafficking. Up until now, you were granted a 30-day reflection period, and after that, your right to stay in the country was very, very much contingent on the extent to which you cooperated with any criminal investigation that surrounded your experience, and for lack of a better way of putting it, how useful that information was. So really how useful you were to the government and the police. And we are seeing a change in that. And so it will be, once again, these will still be victims who have been identified as such with that official, and by victim I do mean that official label that's come down from someone at Border and Immigration, as the government does conceive of trafficking as an immigration issue. It will be that they will be eligible for a 45-day reflection period and a 12-month residence permit that cannot be contingent on cooperation with the authorities. So in a way, on a policy level at least, there are some minor improvements, I think, that are taking place. So just a little positive note.
Yes.
I think that leads us nicely into the next cluster of questions, unless Zach, you want to say something more about agency and the impact on your work? Or?
Sure. I think that the trafficked women have very limited agency, and this is reflected both in their potential claims against clients, because this means that they don't really consent to the sexual encounter with the client, and therefore I think that they should be able to sue successfully in battery. And I would go even one step further and say that since they have been treated as property, they should be able to afford themselves the broader protection that the common law gives to owners of property, so that they should be looked at the same time as subject and object, and the subjects to be able to sue for the way that they've been treated as objects by traffickers, but also by the clients.
Okay.
So that could lead to a strict liability, which is, even if the client didn't know and shouldn't have known that the specific woman was trafficked, still he would have to compensate her in torts for the violation of her right to bodily integrity.
And that still leads us nicely into the next cluster of questions, which relates to how do we actually respond to human trafficking. Now, we've heard two responses so far. There's the Council of Europe Convention on Trafficking. We've got a public law or a private law remedy. It's going the wrong way. Private law remedy here. And earlier in conversation, Helen, you mentioned the Home Office poster that said, "Walk in, a punter; walk out, a rapist."
Yes.
So that was part of a shift.
Yeah, part of a government review on the issue of demand, which started in January this year and involved the Home Office, various ministers visiting the Netherlands, Sweden and Germany to look at various different responses to prostitution, both legislative and non-legislative. And really, there seems to be a move towards placing more responsibility on the buyers, usually men, pay for sex. At the moment they enjoy an unfathomable degree of anonymity in this area and in the whole debate. And we see another positive development is great improvements in multi-agency working, consultation processes, and we have inputs from all sorts of people, individuals, organisations who are concerned about this issue. Consistently absent are the people who pay for sex. And so I think the movement towards demand sanctions above and beyond being prosecuted or fined for curb crawling, if you get caught for the third time, which is currently pretty much all we've got in the UK. The introduction of an offence of controlling someone for gain is under proposal at the moment. And This is a halfway measure compared to something like the Swedish model, which in Sweden they criminalised all forms of purchasing sex in 1999, with a range of results which are hotly contested, but I would summarise them as having significantly reduced street prostitution, had the effect of perhaps displacement of sex buyers to neighbouring countries. The knock-on effect of that has been for Finland to introduce similar legislation, consider introducing similar legislation, and Norway are actually enacting, it will come into force in January 2009. So we can see a knock-on effect of the Swedish model. The UK, I fear, is neither going one way or the other, and has traditionally had a pragmatic fudge on this issue, where the solution of an offence to control for gain is very difficult to prove, which brings us back to private law remedies. My concern around that area is that the involvement of a victim of trafficking in court procedures is obviously extremely distressing. There are very, very few criminal convictions of traffickers, and whilst prosecution is one very important part of counter-trafficking work, they're also preventative to a degree. And the ability to imprison traffickers, I think, is an important part of that. Because there's a potentially limitless pool of victims, sticking a fine on them for something is I think, not the route we should be going, and we should be really seeking to gain as many convictions for traffickers as possible.
Mm-hmm. I definitely agree, Helen, that we have serious issues of access to justice that need to be addressed. So it's not sufficient to accept the approach that I'm proposing, that in terms of substantive causes of action, either by development of the common law or statutory, that there should be a cause of action against clients, for example. But we also need to facilitate the ability of victims to sue, and in this sense, I'm curious whether in the UK there are anti-trafficking organizations with legal departments that they provide legal aid, and I know that in Israel in the last couple of years. There were some claims by victims. One went in a labor court, which is very problematic for me for symbolic reasons. And the result was that the victim got minimum wage, which is also very problematic. But at least there's something. And there's another tort claim against a trafficker that the victim was able to get a verdict in her favor. So I wonder whether we can have something similar, mobilized towards something similar here in the UK.
In terms of compensation for victims in general, in the UK, we've had the best luck with the CICA. Yes, yeah. So the criminal injuries compensation. It's for a couple of reasons. The primary being that that there are many judges in criminal courts here in the UK who either aren't aware or it just doesn't occur to them at the moment to include any kind of compensation. And so sort of training up the judiciary is going to be one part of that, of course. But also because the assets of traffickers are interestingly miraculously gone when they need to be there. And so there have been test cases done where at the end, just because a judgment has come down, it doesn't really mean much of anything, because even though he allegedly has several houses and cars and all of these things, the money can't be found. So in that way, in terms of actually getting the money into the hands of the women who need it, we've had better luck with the state compensation fund. The two cases that we've had from Poppy that have been successful most recently were both women who were granted compensation on the grounds of lost opportunity, and so it doesn't have that same labor component in terms of being the minimum wage, but obviously the idea being what they could have spent their time doing had they not been in the trafficking situation.
And so these claims were against whom?
These were applications made to CICA? To CICA. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, and so that is the most progress we've made so far. In September in Berlin, there was a sort of a European-wide compact, they're calling themselves, launched at several different organizations that are looking at developing compensation in general and all of the different areas in which compensation can be developed, state funds as well as all of the various other legal options, as most EU countries don't have a state fund. So there is a lot of work being done around that, and as far as I know, there is not a counter-trafficking organization in the UK that has its own legal department, although Christmas is coming, and we would be very thankful if anyone wanted to grant us a legal department. But I think we should go. We should have, just have our own court at that point and just finish it all. But yeah, so that's sort of a brief situation about compensation.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, CICA is better than nothing, but I think that it's not enough, both in practical terms and also not in when we fit in terms of principle, especially since the state does profit by seizing traffickers' money and also taxing. And this is also would be my critique of Article 15 of the Council of Europe Convention, because they say this money should be used to compensate victims, but it's victims' money that is being used to compensate them. So, for example, if I'm slapping Emma and taking her wallet, so I shouldn't give her the money from her wallet to compensate her for the slap. This is basically what the suggestion is saying. So I think that money, victims' money that were taken from their pocket because it's the non-consensual proceeds of the labor should get back to them, and then they should get compensation.
I think I'm hearing again is that the voice of the victim isn't being heard in the legislative responses, whether it be at the Council of Europe level or the UK level itself. In the UK, legislation tends to focus on immigration, as you said, Abigail, and on the criminal law, and criminalising perhaps the wrong person in terms of that. So that goes back, I think, Dory, to what you were saying. We need to have agency in here, move away from this deserving poor victim, and we need to be sensitive to the gender issues involved somewhere.
Yes, I think all these legalistic points are obviously important, and we're moving forward, it seems, in very positive directions. Slowly. But in terms of the academic discourse, you won't be surprised to know that I would maintain that we kind of need to move away from these categories of migration, voluntary and consensual versus involuntary and non-consensual migration, because I think that does kind of oversimplify the systems and processes that facilitate migration. So I'm taking it back wider again, really, and I think that kind of approach needs to be criticized, you know, the sort of opposition between forced and voluntary migration. In a way, I know Zach mentioned it earlier, but to me, in what ways are economic pressures less coercive than sort of the physical force or threat you're talking about? So clearly women make that choice, so that in issues of agency, I think there are examples of women with help, I suppose, I mean, in terms of with using the legal system, can help themselves, and they do. There are examples of agency where the sort of previously being tied in exploitative situations, there are examples throughout research that show that they're able to organize themselves in terms of work, organize themselves in terms of self-help groups. So I don't think that should be forgotten. I mean, I think they have to work in tandem with what is available.
I absolutely agree with that, and I think we I don't think this is what you're saying here at all, but we've certainly been accused of, or it seems some people have the notion that we're almost forcing people into the service, whereas their choice really begins when they are referred to the project. And I think economic circumstances can operate, you know, just as strongly as any other. And I don't think it's for us to say, you know, there's one form of coercion is more valid than the other. But I think the fact remains that support services form a central and essential part in the process. And self-organising, I know, has been very successful. Less so, I think, in developed nations. Mm-hmm. And I think that's quite an interesting point as to why that is. Perhaps because there are more resources in the UK to be providing this kind of service. But I think it's also important to bear in mind that the emotional toll involved within the whole process plays a very strong role, and with a self-organizing, self-sustaining unit, I think. Sorry, lost my train of thought.
No, I can see where you're going, but I think what Helen is an issue with me is that in the process of supporting them, I think there should also be these women should also be empowered in the process.
Absolutely.
And that's to me important. So whether self-help or with support,
mm-hmm.
or a combination,
and
sometimes, you know, rather than take away that agency.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not suggesting
no,
doing
you brought
that.
Me back to what the point I was
that's
was getting there, thank you. Which is that I think there are different types of support in different countries and provided by different organisations.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly it's central to the way we work to make sure that each service user, she has her own set of keys, she has her own room,
mm-hmm.
She looks after herself, she cooks her own meals.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't someone on site sleeping there, keeping an eye on them all the time. You know, they're given a weekly allowance, they come and go as they please, and with that come various problems. And they do, amongst themselves, they do organise various things, and there are issues with between different ethnicities,
yeah.
and all sorts of issues, but it's all part of empowering them and encouraging their independence, bearing in mind that a lot of these women, although we only take women aged over 18, quite a few of them have been in trafficking situations
mm-hmm.
during their teenage years, and really have yet to go through their adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a balance to be struck there.
Do you think law can ever be an appropriate tool for addressing, for supporting and for empowering, and where the agency seems to be absent from the legal response, or at least limited or restricted?
I think law can be used rather than abused, and I think as long as the women themselves are being heard, are being listened to, what their particular needs are, and I think that's what can get forgotten in the process and in getting to the target, you know, of the services rather than so.
Well, I know we have had, in terms of sort of compensation and the way that it relates to that and the use of the law, we have had some women, service users who'd been trafficked for prostitution, who indicated that they didn't want any of the resources that had been gained, so to speak, from their exploitation, and were quite adamant about that. On the other side of it, with the women who've been trafficked for labor exploitation, they seem quite empowered by the experience of going to the labor tribunal, the employment tribunal, when they can, for those women whose immigration status allows them to access those services. And I think particularly for women who, when they're in the labor trafficking situation, have several legal processes going on simultaneously, one which may relate to their immigration status, one which may be a criminal claim against their former employer, and then the employment tribunal, which is their opportunity to recoup the funds that they should have had initially and to usually to send those home to their families. And they do seem quite empowered by that experience. And I think it's interesting to juxtapose that with the experience of the criminal prosecutions and the immigration claims, which are usually long, drawn out, very upsetting, very oppressive. You know, there's little room for their voice there. But it does seem to be that in the employment tribunal, oddly, things are quite a bit better. So I think that is one way in which we've seen, at least on the ground, the law being practically empowering for women.
My short answer would be that yes, that law can be an appropriate tool among other things and up to a certain extent. So again, obviously it shouldn't replace other responses, but it should complement them. And more specifically, as I think I've heard here earlier, especially from Abigail, I think that the private law responses have an empowering potential. And then again, I think that the answer is, what do we mean by can law be an appropriate tool? Do we think of it as or more narrowly, the potential of private law being an appropriate tool? So do we think of it as a regulatory mechanism, or we think of it in terms of the victim's right? Mm. So do we think that this would make the difference, tip the scales in terms of deterrence, or do we think of it that it's the victim has a right to sue, and sometimes she might be able to get something? So with respect to the first one, it's hard to know. There are good reasons to suspect, but on the other hand, it also depends on the availability of legal aid that would improve access to justice. And there are some advantages in private law as opposed to criminal law, since, again, you need the lower burden of proof. But if you adhere to the fact that as a matter of right, victims who are interested should be able to sue, so the question what would be the social legal effects become much less important. It's hard for me to see how can someone say that when a woman wants to vindicate a right that has been violated, we would tell her, no, let's don't do that because perhaps it wouldn't be effective.
I suppose, just moving on from that, other responses to human trafficking, we've touched on some legal responses, some demand responses, but I think a lot of the current approach and what's been going on in recent years has been very much curative action, and prevention is another contentious area, and the debate as to whether prevention of trafficking therefore creates prevention of migration as a result. And I think it's a particularly difficult area, which in some debates is almost kept to one side, because it's such a murky area.
Yeah.
And I've been interested in Dori's thoughts on that, and particularly around the the argument that trafficking is really, particularly trafficking into prostitution, is stimulated or caused by poverty in source countries, as opposed to being fueled by demand in destination countries.
It's a tough one. if you take it at a local level, and in fact, very often national governments encourage not prostitution as such, but they want foreign investment, foreign revenue. So blind eye they turn a blind eye to what is going on, and remittances play an important part in the internal economy. So it's problematic, and I think that's why we kind of need to look at it from the push issues as well as the pull factors of the consumer demand as well. I think it's problematic, and there will be those push in a globalized world we live in. As I said at the beginning, on the one hand, you know, we're increasingly mobile, or some of us are, and on the other hand, it's precisely because of that there's increased poverty and displacement and refugees. So it's difficult.
Dori, I agree with what you're saying. I just think that we should complement it with another insight, is that countries of destination also profit to some degree from the trafficking phenomenon, mm-hmm. in financial and other ways. So obviously this should be redressed as well. And as I think I mentioned earlier, part of my project would be to see to what extent victims can sue states of destination.
It's an acknowledgement of the state's role in it, but in country of origin as well as destination.
Yeah. And obviously the pull push question is very hard one to answer empirically, like to what extent the demand is the cause.
Which leads us nicely to the empirical question of how to measure or map trafficking. We know it's there, we know it's happening. Is it a global phenomenon? The US State Department put it at what, the conservative estimate of 600,000 to 800,000 per year?
Well, there's all sorts of figures. Yeah. We've got kind of 27 million people in slavery in some form today. It's possibly the highest end figure. And then within that, where do you start? I mean, the UN, I think, is saying 2 million in Europe, trafficking into Europe. We've had 1,000 referrals to the Poppy Project. And a phrase that's very often bandied around is the tip of the iceberg. And I hate to say it, but that's possibly as accurate as we can get on the numbers, because we simply don't know. And in the UK, we could say there's an estimated 80,000 women involved in prostitution in some form. And some research has found that there's around 80% in London women in prostitution are migrant women or foreign women. So within that, how many are suffering coercion? If anyone wants to chip in here, it's
I think it's very hard to measure, both because of the definitional problems and you know, it's illicit activity. We don't have figures. People have an incentive to hide it. It also relates to what I said earlier. Since states themselves benefits indirectly from it, so they might have an interest in overplaying and downplaying the figures. But then again, we get back to the question: to what extent it's relevant? If we think of it in a regulatory framework of how to control borders and things like that, so it might be more important. But if we think of it in terms of the human rights of the victims, it's enough that the victims that we find, we give them adequate protection, even if we don't know what are the real figures.
Perhaps we won't get an accurate map or way of measuring, but if we include those violation rights within looking at workers who are exploited within the legal system as well, I mean, who are here legally and employed in domestic, I think we have more of a chance of including the extent of, because it's all so covert. That's the problem, and I think because it's sort of associated with the criminal world, it makes it even more difficult. Whereas if we sort of widen it to look at the exploitation that goes on within legalized systems, I think that would help.
Definitely, and we do see a reasonable number, not a very high, but a reasonable number of women who have entered the country, particularly EU women, who have entered the UK at least perfectly legally. And so it is once again that danger of getting caught up in the immigration debate, which is the direction that the government unfortunately just channels mm-hmm. all of this. What had you said? I'm sorry. I was going to respond to it. No,
what's,
it's gone.
What do you think? I'll just
go,
go. Yes.
No,
that's it. I'm sorry. This is, sorry, everyone. In terms of providing victim services, and yes, it is very important that what we're focused on is providing the best services possible to the women who are identified at the moment. We do turn down a significant number of referrals on a regular basis merely because we're full, mm-hmm. you know, and we're actually way above capacity at the moment. And so it is the situation that we do turn away women who even have gone through some of the legal channels already, maybe have an immigration officer has called us, or a solicitor, a doctor, someone else. So on that front, at the moment, we do know we're not doing enough, regardless. So whether or not we know what number it is that we're seeking at the top, 35 is clearly far too low. So I think it is important to always bring those numbers back, at least because it gives us the fuel to argue for things like an expansion of services, which we do need at the moment. Yeah. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think just to add to that, I think we do need to look at numbers as best we can, whilst always mm-hmm. taking into account that none of them are perfectly accurate, because it affects the way policy will go. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And particularly, for example, with relation to legislation around prostitution, there is not a section in the movement arguing for legalisation of prostitution as a means to counter trafficking. The WI in particular springs to mind, wanting to modernise their image and be seen as maybe a bit more with it, called for the legalisation of brothels. I would say it's a very narrow analysis that they've taken by saying, right, if we create lots of neat and tidy brothels, with one of their recommendations on their list of asks in legalisation would be to have sinks at genital height to make sure that men were able to be clean, and that also if a client was violent, they should be barred. These clients should be sent to the police, mm-hmm. be sent to them, and so on. But it's really the notion that if you tidy everything up, it will all be fine. And mm-hmm. as Dory noted, the links to organised criminal networks will always be there, mm-hmm. and with legalisation, as various other countries have shown, they will only increase. Mm-hmm. And as they increase, legalisation attracts sex tourism, mm-hmm. demand goes up, it creates a vacuum for more victims to be brought in, as has been very clearly shown in the Netherlands, mm-hmm. where they're now pretty much doing a U-turn on the policy of legalisation, and considering demand sanctions for clients, mm-hmm. And also raising the age of working up to 21. So I think numbers-wise, whilst we have to treat Daily Mail figures of 50,000 mm-hmm. sex slaves in the UK with great caution, constantly looking, assessing all the different types of mm-hmm. research, and every methodology has its flaws in mm-hmm. this area, yeah. And there is a ongoing efforts to try and improve data collection and statistical analysis, it can only get better.
But two more things about figures. Well, first of all, I agree with Helen that they are important. For example, one thing that they are important is also in evaluating the moral responsibility or culpability of the client for taking the risk. But according to the approach that I support, liability of clients should be strict, for reasons that I can't go into them now. But if some people or policymakers wouldn't agree with me, but would agree that when the client take the risk, if it's too high, that he would subject someone to a non-consensual sex. So obviously, it's important to know what is the percentage of trafficked women of forced prostitutes among all prostitutes. It's evaluate the moral responsibility of the client. And the other point about figures is that again, the methodologies used in order to get to the numbers are very suspected, because it's based on a lot of extrapolation. We know five numbers here, so we and then a list of extrapolations that are very problematic to get to the figures.
Just a quick, sorry, I want to just quickly pick up on one tiny point you made about the responsibility on clients as to whether it's someone who's forced or not. I think any buyer, anyone who buys sex has to take responsibility for that, that it doesn't matter if the person they're having sex with has been trafficked or not. They are contributing to demand for prostitution,
yeah.
Full stop. And alongside that, the notion that you can just say to someone, have you been trafficked? Or that trying to check for bruises is no way to establish identification.
I agree with that, and actually part of my bigger project would be to see whether we could impose liability on clients for the creation of demand. Which is something that many people obviously would think is again, but I'm talking about civil liability, not criminal.
Dory?
Oh, I guess what I wanted to add earlier to Helen's point is in terms of figures and statistics is maybe we need to give to hear the voices of the women themselves and some complement or try and get some qualitative data in terms of interviewing the women. I don't know how much has been done, really, but because of the covert nature of the business, it may be difficult to obtain, but I think it will be worthwhile. I mean, and that would give us a better understanding.
We have had quite a few research projects that have focused around that. Generally speaking, the research will take the form of more of a questionnaire because in an effort not to re-traumatize the women, the research is done sort of one stage removed. So a questionnaire administered by their support worker in a supportive environment and the data fed back to us. We had a report that was, actually I think it's just about to be released. The research was finished over the summer called Roots In, Roots Out, Quantifying the Gendered Experience of Trafficking into the UK, and that does evaluate pre-trafficking risk factors such as experience of violence as a child, where women come from in their country of origin, rural or urban areas, levels of education, things like that. Several different components of the trafficking experience itself, from the actual movement and false documents to things like being controlled, being followed, all sorts of different things, physical violence, psychological violence, threats, it covers all of it. And so we do have a pretty good idea, I think, about the multiple ways in which women are exploited, although in no way should that be interpreted as sort of a typical profile of a trafficked woman, because I don't really think we can say that exists. But once again, that speaks to sort of the multiplicity of experiences and voices that show us that actually, yes, there's a whole range of different ways in which women are exploited and abused in this entire process. So it's not perfect research, again, but there is some out there that focuses on that.
I just want to finish with one question because I'm aware of time. How do you think we can help each other as academics and activists in this particular area?
I think activists can help me a lot by giving me information either that you have or that people that might have them, because in order to defend and develop these kind of claims, we need to know lots of information, like how much money does the state confiscate from traffickers or the tax system, again, to try, I think that we can try and collaborate in terms of creating like legal aid to victims, to perhaps through activists, willing, interested victims could know about the potential of claims, perhaps there could be collaboration in like helping them through. Obviously, there are issues of funding here, but there's also issues of like what academics would call legal consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the activist role is crucial for that.
Dory, as a non-legal academic?
As a non-legal academic, I think, yes, it's that the gap can be bridged, information exchange, and certainly sometimes us academics work in very theoretical paradigms, mm-hmm. and I'd like to be a bit more in touch with what is going on
the ground.
On the ground, and the research Abigail just mentioned, for example, and sort of more exchange, really. So I think, yes, and maybe vice versa, and mm-hmm. you know. So I think, yeah, we can help each other. More events like this, in some ways.
Mm-hmm. I would. Just one more thing. I think that if you as activists are being invited to the policy making meeting, so perhaps you could try and like take us with you.
Yes.
Well, like, certainly there's a growing amount of interagency working, I think, mm-hmm. and it can only be beneficial. I think this has been very interesting, and seeing different perspectives is very helpful as well, and being reminded of them. And constantly having input from different areas. I think it's fair to say that there is a huge amount of work going on in this area at every level, from mm-hmm. community grassroots groups to, you know, high-level policy. And it is a question of joining up all those dots and bringing it together. And I think things are going in the right direction. And thank you for organising this. It's been really interesting.
And that note, we'll say thank you to everybody. So thank you very much for all participating.
Thank you.
And I'd just like to open it up to the small invited audience if they've got any questions to pose to the participants, or if the participants themselves have got a niggly little question that they want to... Yes, Harriet?
I'm Harriet Summers from the University of Westminster. I wanted to come back to the question of agency again. And I think the reason is that in the last year I've been to two conferences where two... scholars, feminist scholars, have just been so absolutely adamant on these issues of agency that they see much of the NGO work and much of the regulation work done by the state as actually harming the people who they're trying to help. And I guess the two examples that I've been given, and they're not necessarily views that I myself have, but one of them was one feminist scholar was talking about NGOs in Nepal, preventing women in Nepal from going to the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And she was talking about how she felt that was wrong because those women were trying to improve their situation. They didn't really have any opportunities. And this was a choice that they were making and that it was wrong mm-hmm. to interfere. And then the other scholar was talking about Eastern Europe and some of the ex-Soviet mm-hmm. states where women were wanting to leave those countries to come to other countries in order to improve their economic situation, and she felt that that was for them to assess those risks and to go ahead with that. The other sort of example as well was that in some countries there were very severe restrictions being put on migrant workers who wanted to leave, and the restrictions really were kind of anti-trafficking,
mm-hmm.
I find these views quite problematic myself. Maybe for some of the reasons that you've been talking about here, but I was wondering how you respond to that. That in fact, you know, some of these restrictions and laws that NGOs lobby for are actually making it more difficult for people, and particularly for women, to improve their situation.
Do you have a specific example?
Well, the Nepal, actually, that's...
UK one, or...?
Necessarily thinking in terms of the UK, but more sort of globally, but just in terms of the UK, in terms of, greater restrictions being put on women, and that the regulations were making it harder for them to migrate. That in itself was something that was disadvantageous.
I think the example from Nepal is interesting, particularly because it was the law in Nepal, not just something that NGO workers were supporting, but the restrictions on women moving particularly to the Middle East until 2000. And so that's only recently changed. And that had come out of sort of a long history of restrictive immigration rules that had to do with women seeking permission from a male family member, and that weren't necessarily as intricately linked to any sort of attempts to control migration or trafficking as such, but really just to control women. In terms of assessing risks, we were at a conference in Vienna earlier this month, and I was speaking with some colleagues who work on a hotline. They take calls from women predominantly in Eastern Europe who are thinking about migrating abroad, and they will give them an example of either someone they've met who's promised them a job or something else, and it's the role of the person on the hotline apparently to give them some feedback about that, whether or not they think that that is a risky situation. We don't have a hotline, an operational hotline in the UK at the moment. Debate about that, extremely contentious as well. But in terms of assessing the risk and whose responsibility that is, and I think it is very tricky because we know that a lot of the women who we see on the project, when asked about what types of expectations they had and what promises were made to them, obviously it's extremely different. And particularly when you had women who were very young or women, we see many women with learning disabilities. And so the extent to which they can be misled into not being able to assess the risks properly can be very high, and that can't be forgotten as well. So,
I would just add to that. I think it really underlines your question. Really underlines the responsibilities that are borne by the destination country and members of the public in the destination country, whether it's people paying sex or consumers of goods produced by trafficked people or services offered by them, because I think the fact is people will always seek to migrate, and as an arch advocate, a no borders kind of solution in some ways, but I think that's extremely idealistic and perhaps entirely unrealistic way to go. And I think it ties in with the very laudable aim of tackling global poverty in order to prevent trafficking. It's never going to happen. So we need to look at legislation and more pinpointed and immediate solutions, or shorter term solutions, I suppose, that can be addressed. And I think with immigration restrictions, states may have the best of intentions. And I certainly think NGOs lobbying, it depends. And I always come back to prostitution because that's my area. But I think, I probably made it clear that I think lobbying for demand sanctions rather than legalisation is the way to safeguard. But there's obviously a lobby which disagrees entirely with that.
I mean, I agree. I think it's very hard to answer this question in the abstract. Mm-hmm. So we need to examine carefully what is the situation that these women face, what are the promises that were made, and also what are the responses. So obviously if the responses are to view the victims as the problem or as the offenders and kick them back home, so that would be problematic, but I don't think that that's what organizations like Poppy and others are advocating for. I think, as Helen suggested, that the solution should be both to target demand and obviously to make sure that the working conditions of the victims in non-prostitution areas are improved. I also, like Helen, don't think that the legalization of prostitution is the solution, but there are many other things that could be done. And I would be very cautious not to adhere to a falsified notion of agency of these women who are faced with very poor choices. And as one feminist, regretfully, I don't remember the name, says there's no... and no 9-year-old dreams to become a prostitute when she'll be old.
Mm-hmm. Daniela?
Yeah, I just have a quick comment, really. I don't know, I take issue with penalizing demand. I think that's very, very problematic. I think what happens is if you go down that sort of law and order approach is that you start penalizing men who themselves might be quite vulnerable. And I find that... I don't know, you know, sort of, how do you discipline demand? I don't think you can ever eliminate demand. I think prostitution is always going to be around. You know, whether you restrict it or not, it's going to be there. And I find it problematic that you would, you know, potentially discriminate men who might see going to a prostitute as their only way of having sexual intercourse, or, you know, who are probably don't have an opportunity to have it otherwise, or who are quite marginalized in society themselves. So I just I think it's problematic to think of it in terms of the
okay.
law and order approach.
Two quick answers. First, I'm not sure what you mean by penalizing, again, whether you think that the criminal response is inadequate or a civil response in terms of compensation. I don't have clear thoughts in my mind about how appropriate is a criminal response. I think that the compensation, a civil response, is appropriate. And the other thing, I take issue with some of your factual assumptions, because research tells that clients come from all socioeconomic background, so it's not that they are only the marginalized. So in terms of distributive justice, we have the victims who are the most marginalized and clients who are heterogeneous. So liability should bring about the progressive results. And also, research shows that it's not true that only men that don't have any other possibility. You know, many married men and people with long and short-term relationship of non-sex do purchase sex.
I agree with that, but I think again that you would be even further marginalizing an already marginalized group amongst men as well. And I think that is quite problematic.
Yeah.
I don't think you're going to stop demand. Even if you're
this is another issue that we don't have time to address, but I think, again, the crucial point is who's more marginalized, those marginalized men that can't have sex otherwise, or those women that are raped because these other men don't have other options to get...
But I think that goes back to the question of agency then, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do we really know that all of these women are there against their will? Perhaps
mm-hmm.
some of them do choose to stay on. And I was also wondering, just very quickly, in terms of whether anybody here has done any research on whether some of these women might actually see it as an improvement to be in a situation in which, yes, they are trafficked and they might live, you know, under terrible circumstances to us in Britain, but perhaps come from a situation in which there was an armed conflict, in which, you know, there were huge issues around human security, human safety, and, you know, they might find that an improvement, actually, to where they were coming from. And, you know, one of the areas I'm thinking of is the Balkans, again, Kosovo, you know, because I do have a bit of experience, you know, in the region. And, you know, I just find that, from at least sort of from what I've read and, you know, people I've spoken to, that some of the women actually find being here an improvement to as opposed to where they came from. Not to say that this is an ideal solution, but I think... You know, again, it really goes back to listening to women's voices and perhaps not victimizing them before we have actually heard their voices.
Abigail, mm-hmm. I think you're ready for a response there. just
a very tiny comment is all, which is that we have fought long and hard for a human rights-based approach to this entire situation, and you unfortunately do not have the right not to be marginalized, and you don't have the right to sex. So in terms of making a population of men who have trouble accessing sexual intercourse otherwise, in terms of marginalizing them, that is not a human rights violation. It may even be unfortunate, but technically speaking, I mean, particularly if we're going to take a legal approach to it, it just isn't. So I think putting that within a human rights framework, and certainly not... Even if you did want to make an argument for sex as a human right, intriguing, or paying for sex as a human right, the right to purchase sex is something within that framework. I still think that even if you could justify that as a right, that it wouldn't justify
mm-hmm.
the violation of bodily integrity, or you know, wouldn't justify rape. It wouldn't justify something else like that. So I think, in terms of putting it
but
in a human rights framework,
all prostitution,
no.
all sex that happens between
no, not all, but some of them.
Adults is non-consensual.
No. It definitely doesn't assume that,
okay.
but it does assume that, and this is something that should be checked empirically. But it does assume that the demand contributes to the fact that some women that otherwise wouldn't have been trafficked or forced into prostitution do, and this is the basis of the claim.
And I wanted to respond to from that your comment about, you know, isn't it better to be selling sex in the UK than living in a conflict zone? And I think that really is the crux of the issue, that if someone is having to sell sex in order to survive, that's where our real duties
mm-hmm.
kick in
mm-hmm.
as a
global
state,
citizens.
As interested, concerned organisations, as anyone else, say you don't have to do that, you should not have to do that.
And I think, yes, I think prostitution will always exist. It has always existed, and that's bandied around as a cliche, and it's certainly seen, I know from a feminist organisation, in some ways, you said we were working for the eradication of prostitution, but I think, we're being realistic here. But the fact is, I think what we're working towards is a situation where anyone who doesn't want to sell sex doesn't have to. People who want to will always find a way to do it, and they're not really going to be affected by whatever measures are taken. They will carry on. But the fact is, demand is increasing as sexually exploitative or just increased sexual images in society, commodification. And I'm just looking at all the video games out now where you can make traffic, you can make all these things. So all of that
I think
is
it goes
difference.
Back to education, to cultural.
Yes.
That's the bottom line.
Well, to a degree, but I think the normative effect of demand sanctions plays an important part in this. So you need to get into
One more thing, Daniela. The law does generally impose limits on my ability to exploit your vulnerability. So if you're going to drown and I'm telling you, give me $1 million and I will save you and you will give me, the law wouldn't enforce that. So even if there is some kind of improvement, which is a contested question, it's something that I don't have answers, and it might be that different victims would give you different answers, it doesn't necessarily say that even if subjectively they think that have been improved, that it's not a reason for us as a society to penalize either in a civil way or criminal way this exploitation.
Dory, would you like to have the last word?
I'm not sure about the last word. I agree with what Helen, Zach and Abigail have been saying. I'm not sure about Daniela's perspective on prostitution always being here and taking the male perspective there. But to go back to Harriet's original question, I think, yes, I was advocating to move away from the victim status, but sometimes the notion of agency is overemphasized and sometimes harmfully. And a respect also for cultural differences sometimes can harm women. So I think we have to work with the national governments, with the cultural customs of the country, but we have an obligation here to protect. So that's my last word.
An obligation to protect. That's a good way to end it. So I'll say thank you very much to everybody for having a fascinating conversation. Definitely opened my eyes. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.